The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. Century of Lies is a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. On Friday, October 28th, the New Mexico State Legislature's Legislative Health and Human Services Committee and its Courts, Corrections, and Justice Committee, both of which are House-Senate joint committees, met together to talk about opiate policies, including prescription monitoring, alternative health care, and addiction treatment, including treatment with heroin. They heard testimony from Eugenia Oviedo-Yux, an associate professor at the School of Population and Public Health at the University of British Columbia, Canada, Miriam Suzanne Komorami, MD, an associate professor of medicine at the University of New Mexico, Andrew Shi, MD, a professor of family and community medicine at the UNM, and Lindsay LaSalle, a senior staff attorney for the Drug Policy Alliance. Last week, we heard some of their testimony, so this week, we're going to listen as they reply to questions from the legislators. Let's just get to it.
Okay, we'll go to, did anybody else want to add anything? We'll go to questions from committee members. Chairman Ortiz-Pino.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll start with some questions for Dr. Oviedo. The use of heroin-assisted treatment is... I'll tell you how intriguing it is. Somebody from U.S. News and World Report called me yesterday to say, I hear you're going to have testimony on heroin-assisted treatment. And I looked at our agenda, and I didn't know we were going to have testimony on it. But I think he may be listening in if we didn't lose him over the lunch break. So there's a great deal of interest. There's curiosity, I guess. And so I wanted to ask you about the European experience with it and also the British Columbian experience. Is it time limited, or is the idea that the person who would be in this type of treatment would just continue for the rest of their life in it? Or is there an effort to gradually taper them off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Sorry. Thank you for the question. It's a question that always comes up. And I would like to answer in the way that what this treatment is meant for is to meet patients where they are at and start working from there on the many issues they bring to treatment after so many years to have been left behind by the healthcare system. So what is the intention as a physician, as a researcher, as a care provider? Always to do the best for our patients. It will depend on each patient how this best will going to look like. We had a very interesting discussion this morning, and sometimes I remind people, if we have patients, for example, that are around our average age in clinical trials in Europe and also in British Columbia, is around between 40 and 45, and they haven't been able to work either because they have been sick or because they lack skills because they have not been able to access them, just starting this treatment is not going to put them back in the workforce. There will have to be a huge deal of reinvestment in social skills, working skills, education. The main priority of this treatment when we receive a client or a person for the first time is to keep this person safe. That's the main priority. Once we have established that the person is going to continue come and we start seeing them 3 times per day, we start working in other areas. We have extremely successful stories in terms of what other people think success is. For example, leaving the treatment. There are a lot of people, particularly in studies from Switzerland, they have been running this for the last 20 years, where people have come back and taper out and stop using any kind of drugs. But also, you will see in these programs 30% of the people that yearly are part of this cohort move to either methadone or buprenorphine. This treatment is, you need to come 3 times per day to a clinic. So it is a treatment for people that are really either very poor or with very poor social skills or very, very limited recovery capital. And we try to expand that recovery capital in a way that they can start moving forward. It is true, a lot of people will stay in this treatment for several years or move to methadone or to buprenorphine or become abstinent. But let's not forget that opioid dependency is a chronic illness. So they are going to be back and forth. What we're trying to do is to always have a treatment that a person can access in the moment they need it. In our cohort in British Columbia, we so far, most of our clients have been there. 2011, we're in 2017, in and out, maybe 2, 3, 4 years. And we have particular one case that she stopped drugs altogether. She never came back for treatment. She finished her nursing degree, and now she is practicing as a nurse. Those cases exist, but the majority of the people we reach is people that are really poor, that they live mostly on disability, that they are homeless, and they live in single hotel room occupancy. So there is a lot that we as a community need to do to catch up in order for them to have something to go once they reach some stability on their treatment. I hope that answers the question.
And Mr. Chairman, then I guess I'm intrigued by the possibility of New Mexico engaging in a pilot of this sort. And Dr. Kumarmi and Dr. Shi, is there any interest, or would there be a way for UNM to participate in this that you could see? Or is there even any talk about it?
There has been some talk about the idea of safe injection facilities, which in some way are sort of a cousin of this concept. So that's where someone who is not being prescribed heroin but is using heroin that they obtain on the street has a place where they can inject safely without risk of dying of an overdose. And also, as you were saying, it helps to engage them and start to talk to them about other options.
Some of the other social supports or case management.
Yeah. I haven't heard anyone at UNM propose heroin-assisted treatment, although I agree that the evidence is strong for its benefit. It will certainly be a major lift to introduce this in New Mexico if we're going to go that route. But worthwhile. I think it's really true that there are people who are not reached by the other therapies that we have, and as long as those people are... they're suffering, they're at risk of early death, they're becoming infected and putting others at risk of infection,
they're committing... They're having to steal to maintain their
habit. That's right, yep. And so in from a public health standpoint, I think both the idea of safe injection facilities and this type of therapy are things that we should consider. Dr. Shi, did you want to comment?
What do you think, Dr. Shi?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee at Senator Ortiz-Pino, I can only speak from the perspective of looking at family systems that the medication part of the treatment is incredibly important in terms of stabilizing individuals. But I would have a very hard time managing a large population of people on methadone, buprenorphine, or injectable heroin if I had not built a team that could simultaneously address the social needs and the developmental needs of the children in the families. And it's that relationship with the child that seems to be a large motivator for the next set of things that happen. I think also that the issue of counseling and access to counseling is a critical problem for any of the programs that are providing services. And I would say specifically the issue of gender-specific treatment that's trauma-informed for women who are using, injecting drugs. Because their situation is, in my view, very different than the larger population of people who have substance use disorder. there is good data that says that people have dopamine accentuation with the anticipation of injecting, and that while buprenorphine does a good job in blocking opioid receptors that then prevent craving and withdrawal, that the injecting part of it is a powerful motivator for people to seek drugs. Now, the question would be is whether something like injectable heroin or Dilaudid or something else might be the answer to the dopamine stimulation around the behavior of injection drug use.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow that up, that's fascinating because I've often heard that the whole ritual around preparing the stuff and injecting it, and that is a powerful. At your program, do they inject themselves, or is there a nurse or a physician who does the injection?
In British Columbia and Canada, the nurse cannot push the medication for matter of liability if anything happens. So the nurse can help find a vein, because if you can picture our clients or people that don't look healthy because they've been in the street and they have many other issues. So many of them have been injecting for so long they don't find the vein. So sometimes the nurses will help find a vein. In countries like in Spain, there was not a liability issue, so sometimes when they're called on, the nurses will help. But it becomes extremely medicalized. So you see, the ritual, it comes as, it's like one, it takes a bit of the flavor of the ritual itself. The injection is still there, but you are in a place with nurses and lights, and then you are handed a basket with all what you need to inject. You see your physician. So it becomes for them, when you listen to them, how they express, is their medication. It's not anymore the drug for them. Now is my medication. And they take a lot of pride on being able to say that this medication is working for them, and how they look forward to starting improving in other areas of their lives, such as sometimes it's just to have food on their covers, and how much they have improved on that, and making plans or being able to follow up plans with their families, knowing if I say I'm going to be there on Tuesday, I'm actually going to be there on Tuesday because I have the schedule at the clinic, and after that I can move. So how they can structure the life around a medical place where this street drug becomes a medication.
You're listening to Century of Lies, a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We're listening to a hearing before two joint committees of the New Mexico State Legislature. They're discussing opiates, medication-assisted treatment, and heroin maintenance. Let's get back to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can see that it would take a lot for us to do this. We're going to need a staff. We need a support team. We would need federal approval, all sorts of stuff that would have to go into it. But that we're talking about it, I think, is a healthy sign. And I think pretty clearly that there is that resistant population in our state currently to our current efforts at reaching them. We're just not reaching all the people that we need to. One thing about this is it kind of takes away the marketing of black market heroin that goes on. I mean, you know, it kind of robs the hey kid, come here, I got a real high for you here, when you can get that at the hospital in a medication form. So,
and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have been partnering with the Vancouver Police Department and other sections of the police, because they're really interested on expanding the treatment because of the fentanyl crisis. And they're asking, the Ministry of Health have received a lot of pressure from the police, asking for them to start competing with the black market and start prescribing this opiates for people that are already dependent, with severe opiate use dependence. This is not for other, maybe other groups of people that have been encounter opioid use through pain. This is a totally different group of we're working with. But a big push is, because of the black market, and bringing medically prescribed medications, either Dilaudid or diazepam morphine. So that is an important component of the crisis. And I want to tag along what Doctor was saying about the buprenorphine and the fact that it is true that we need counseling and we need all these services, but people come for the medication. You give placebo and they leave. So people come to our clinics because of the medication, but what we do, it's not about the medication, it's about caring for people and being able to offer all these resources that we know are the ones that are going to bring true change in our lives and in the life of our community.
Thank you. Dr. Kumari.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I wanted to just add one more comment that Senator Ortiz-Pino, when you mentioned that this type of program could undercut the black market, I think a corollary of that is when you think about what goes on in prison, where there's a huge black market for buprenorphine, if you actually provided the people who want buprenorphine and need it as treatment with buprenorphine in the prison, that would also eradicate that black market and would stop that illegal trade that goes on.
I wish you were here yesterday when the corrections people were here. They're very stubborn about that idea.
They certainly don't share my ideas about it. I think that's definitely true. Thank you, sir.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee and Senator Ortiz-Pino, I think the one other thing, though, to consider is that most of the overdoses in New Mexico are combined methadone plus other opiate overdoses. And injectable dilaudid or injectable heroin does not block heroin opiate receptors so that the respiratory center of the brain could not be overwhelmed if an individual were to access other opiates, fentanyl or anything else, outside of the clinic time that they are being treated. So those are additional issues that need to be considered in the overall structure of the therapeutic program in those kinds of treatment models.
Thank you. Representative Armstrong, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, panel. I've got a couple of specific questions for you. Just to try and get a sense of how it works, and I think you said some people take it for many years, maybe a lifetime use, or is so that was one question, how long, but how often? I thought I heard you say 3 times a day they come in.
So each clinic in Europe works a bit differently because of the opioid receptors. You will like to offer this at least. Offer it for 3 times per day so people do not go through withdrawal through night. You will have places like the Netherlands, what we call the Dutch model. They offer 2 injections and you have to take home a small dose of methadone to pass the night until the next day. Or you have some clinics in Zurich, the biggest clinic, where they have, you can come anytime you want and you can come 11 times per day if you want. And because the opiate system has a natural ceiling, people do not go up and up and up. They will find a comfortable dose and stick to that. So, yes, the model could be, we offer in British Columbia up to 3 times per day. It's optional if you want to take oral methadone and the last dose to combine it. So some people, very few people take co-prescribed methadone. Most of them rather come the 3 times per day.
Mm-hmm. And is it self-injected? So you give them prescription grade? And a clinic safe place to inject, but is it a combination of that safe place to inject so that they're self-injecting?
So the clinic will work like this. You will meet first with the physician and have a conversation and start a working plan. After that, you will start what we call a titration, when we are going to raise up 50 milligrams every half hour until you feel comfortable. Once that between you and the nurse have figured out what is your dose, the physician will write that prescription. Then that prescription gets in the database, and then the pharmacist is going to prepare a personalized, individualized vial for Deborah, in this case. So Deborah Armstrong will have her own vial. Let's say you have your morning dose is 120 milligrams. So you will come that day, you will have a bar scan. We will give you your medication, and then if you pass the test, the nurse is going to say, how are you doing? Are you fine? You seem fine. Do you want your 120 or you want less? I want a bit less today. So we will pour 20 milligrams in a place that is registered, because we need to report all the medication that is there. And then we give you everything, and you sit in one of the five seats that we have in the Crosstown Clinic. And you might say, can I have some help today? I don't feel like I can do this on my own. So a nurse will come and help you find a vein, and then you will inject that on your own.
Okay. Wow. Mr. Chair, is it still all within a clinical trial context, or are you out of a clinical trial and just practicing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Deborah Armstrong, right now Crosstown Clinic operates outside of the clinical trial. The last patient leaving the clinical trial was one and a half years ago. We have 140 patients, former participants of the Salome clinical trial, that still receive either diacetylmorphine through SAPs or hydromorphone.
That was from a hearing before two joint committees of the New Mexico legislature. They were discussing opiate use, medication-assisted treatment, and heroin maintenance. The speakers included Eugenia Oviedo-Yox, an associate professor at the School of Population and Public Health at the University of British Columbia, Canada, Miriam Suzanne Komorami, M.D., an associate professor of medicine at the University of New Mexico, Andrew Shi, M.D., a professor of family and community medicine at the UNM, and Lindsay LaSalle, a senior staff attorney for the Drug Policy Alliance. While we still have time, let's listen in on a recent news briefing at the U.S. Department of State. Spokesperson John Kirby was being questioned about the Philippines and a recent decision by the U.S. government to stop the sale of more than 20,000 rifles to the Philippine National Police.
Philippines? So, I don't know if you will have seen Philippine President Duterte's response to our story about the United States not proceeding with a planned sale of 26,000 rifles to the Philippines. Among other things, he has called the people behind the decision not to proceed with the sale fools and, quote, monkeys. I know you addressed this to some degree yesterday, and I know that there are limitations on what you can say about right. such a pending or potential sale. But it's the last in a long series now of angry statements, critical statements, harsh statements from the Philippine president toward the United States. Do you have any response to his comments on this matter, even if you can't discuss the underlying sale?
No, actually, I don't, Arshad. I have seen those comments through press reporting. I would say what we've said so many times before, that that kind of rhetoric is really at odds. And I think the word that I've used before is inexplicably at odds with the close relationship that we continue to have with not just the Filipino people, but the Filipino government. But I can't account, for the sentiments expressed in those comments. All I can do is, and as you rightly noted, I can't comment about potential commercial licenses in advance either. The decisions that affect them. But all I can do is reaffirm again how dedicated we are to our bilateral relationship with the Philippines, to our people-to-people ties with the Filipino people, and, in fact, how seriously we take our commitments from a security perspective through the defense treaty that we share.
You said that you talked about how his remarks were inexplicably at odds with the close relationship that you have, not just people to people, but also with the government. Do you mean the government excluding Mr. Duterte, or would you say that you have...
Well, he's the head of state. He's the head of the government.
You feel like you have a close relationship with him?
Absolutely. Well, we have a close relationship with the government of the Philippines.
Including him, the head of...
Well, he's newly elected, and I don't know the depth to which we've had opportunities to engage on a personal level with him. I know Secretary Kerry met with him and came away from that meeting, as he said he did, feeling positive about where things were going to be going with the Philippines. I don't know about our ambassador and the personal relationship that he might have been able to develop in this short period of time, but he is the head of state, and our government-to-government relations are very strong.
How can you say that you have a close relationship with the government when you can't say that you have a close relationship with the head of state?
Well, because the government doesn't rest, especially in a democracy, it doesn't rest on the shoulders of just one individual. Yes, he's the head of state, but there are many agencies in his government. There are many cabinet officials. There are longstanding relationships that we have nurtured over the years with figures in his government, and those relationships are still there, and they're still vibrant.
And last one on this, do you remain open to, two things. One, by saying that the government doesn't rest on the shoulders of one individual, are you trying to suggest that you would try to circumvent him or deal with
Not
others?
At all.
Or,
no.
Okay.
No.
And then second,
I was simply referring to the fact that in a democratic government, and such as the Philippines, that tasks are delegated to various agencies, and that we have relationships with these institutions and agencies. Those are solid. They remain. Obviously, you also need to develop a good working relationship with the head of state. And I can tell you, as I've said before from this podium, we're committed to doing that.
Thank you.
I'm not quite sure I get are you trying to suggest something here?
No.
I mean, the head of state determines the foreign policy of the government, much in the Philippines
That's
as
correct.
In the United States.
Right. Which
point? But you're saying that the U.S., that you've built up relationships with other parts of the government, so it doesn't matter what the president thinks?
That's not at all what I said.
Okay.
It wasn't at all what I implied. I mean, look, he's the head of state. We recognize he's the duly elected leader of the Philippine government, and we respect that. And we respect the fact that, as the head of state, he determines foreign policy. We totally understand it. The point I was trying to make is that that there are institutions in the government that we have good relationships with, and we're going to try to continue those relationships, as well as try to develop a good working relationship with him himself. That's all I meant.
All right.
That's all I meant.
Okay. Can we go to the Senate?
That again was from a press conference at the U.S. State Department. Those rifles would have been used to slaughter innocent people. Stopping that sale was the only option. Thousands of innocent lives have been lost in the Philippines because of Duterte's death squads. He has other people pulling the triggers, yet the dictator of the Philippines, President Rodrigo Duterte, is ultimately responsible for the extrajudicial murders that continue to be carried out in that country. Duterte has to go. Until then, remember, it's hashtag boycott the Philippines. And, well, that's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back next week with 30 minutes of news and information about the drug war and this century of lies. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.